Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Emily Burt.
And I'm Lucinda Rouse. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. This week's topic is a heavy one. We'll be talking about forms of trauma often experienced by charity and humanitarian workers. And we'll get some thoughts from our guest on the process of trauma healing at both an individual and an organisational level.
But first, we're joined today by our senior news reporter, Emily Hall, and she's going to tell us about a new piece of research that she has reported on in the last week. So hi, Emily, how are you doing?
Hi, good, thank you.
And what have you got to tell us about today?
So we reported on some recent, very interesting research about the so-called NGO halo effect from academics at Erasmus University. To summarise an 120-page long dissertation, it essentially argues that the idealisation of charitable organisations makes it easier for staff and volunteers to downplay or completely ignore unethical behaviours. This was described as the NGO halo effect, which the paper broke down into three different mechanisms. They were moral justification, moral superiority, and moral naivety. The researchers conducted a survey of charity employees in different countries and found that these three traits were common among staff. They also found an extremely deep connection with their cause area, a belief that their organisation is the best at what they do, and a belief that the staff at the charity inherently know what is right or wrong. The thesis goes on to argue that the vast majority of unethical behaviour in NGOs could be explained by at least one of these halo effect mechanisms. And if this is the case, it opens the door to a whole range of concerns about the justification of misconduct or ethical malpractice in charities. For example, in one interview, a respondent said that you shouldn't need a code of conduct written down to know what is right and what is wrong. From that alone, you can see how a feeling of moral superiority could lead to a lack of proper conduct practices and policies, things that are required to keep any organisation ethical.
Absolutely. And what I would say is that, you know, we hear quite often in the sector that bad behaviour can go overlooked and there is a tendency to go, oh, but we're the good guys. You know, there's no harassment in our organisation. There's no bullying going on here. Of course, we're not institutionally racist. We're the good guys. Like, we're the charity sector. This fascinating. And as you say, 123 pages long, very in-depth thesis. It ties into a lot of common themes that we've actually been hearing about for many, many years in the sector now.
I think it's absolutely wild, actually, that the findings have come out now, because certainly reporting on the sector, I have the impression that organisations are thinking really, really deeply about their organisational culture and making sure that they are putting the appropriate policies in place to mitigate the risk of this misconduct. But clearly, it's still very much a problem.
And I think it's important to bear in mind that this is also a global piece of research, right? So this may not be applicable across the entirety of every single country that we're looking at. But it is, as you say, interesting to see when you're reporting on the sector that there does tend to be this second guessing and this really deep thought. I mean, that's what I have perceived as well. So I found it incredibly fascinating reading through this and seeing some of the attitudes of the different people who were being spoken to in these interviews. And the things they were saying did seem to use this moral superiority to justify, no, we don't really need the code of conduct.
And did the report provide any recommendations on how organisations can overcome the NGO halo effect, as it's called?
Well, it seems to be quite an entrenched issue if it's, you know, the attitudes of the staff. So it's quite difficult to pinpoint an exact solution. But it did recommend a couple of things. So it recommended that charities adopt a more bespoke approach to ethics management, and that NGO leadership should not just be reactive, but should also try to foresee potential ethical issues by actively seeking out areas where there's moral idealization or exaggeration within their organizations. How they do that, that's up for debate. And I think that could be a whole extra dissertation in itself.
Well, as Lucinda said, I do think there has been some deep thinking going on in the UK charity sector. So perhaps we could draw on the experiences of our own listeners to start building the foundations for that dissertation. But of course, don't want to fall into the moral superiority of the framework by assuming that the UK charity sector is merely streets ahead from every single one of its global counterparts.
Moving on to this week's main discussion. We're here to talk about the susceptibility of humanitarian and charity workers to trauma in their professional lives. So what is trauma? I'm very grateful to the good people at Mind for the comprehensive resources on trauma on their website. So a definition in their words: trauma is when we experience very stressful, frightening, or distressing events that are difficult to cope with or out of our control. It could be one incident or an ongoing event that happens over a long period of time. Most of us will experience an event in our lives that could be considered traumatic, but we won't all be affected the same way. Trauma can happen at any age, and it can affect us at any time, including a long time after the event has happened. So we're delighted to be joined from Virginia in the United States by Dimple Dabalia, the founder of a mental health consultancy with a specialism in healing from individual and organizational trauma and moral injury. And she's recently published a book on the topic called Tell Me My Story, Challenging the Narrative of Service Before Self. Hi, Dimple.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. So just to get started, could you please tell us in what ways are charity workers placed in traumatic situations, perhaps more than other professions?
Yeah, so I think the nature of, so I call it humanitarian work, and humanitarian work I define as basically any work that's being done to alleviate pain and suffering in the world. And I was just thinking about that this morning, you know, with people in these lines of work, I think part of the problem is that we're working, you know, often really long hours in high-risk conditions, often having to make decisions in kind of life or death situations that affect other people's lives. There's often a struggle for supplies and needed resources. And then there's also just a lot more in terms of moral challenges that come up, and that creates a high level of stress. And so all of this contributes to what I call widening your window of stress tolerance. And so the reason that people in these positions, so we think about social workers, counselors, healthcare professionals, aid workers, government workers, the clergy, they play such a pivotal role in addressing societal challenges and alleviating pain and suffering that all of this weighs on our window of stress tolerance. And so when we talk about window of tolerance, this is really how resourced are we to address stress as it arises? And so, you know, if you think about a ship that's kind of sailing along, and so when we're in our window of tolerance, we're in that space of kind of smooth sailing where, you know, things are coming up, we're able to manage it, and we continue to move forward. But when we're outside of our window of tolerance, we're in kind of rough waters, essentially. And so we can be either in a space of hyper arousal or hypo arousal. But people with wider windows are much more tolerant of uncertainty and ambiguity. And they're a lot more flexible when life, you know, throws these curveballs at us and when things don't go as we planned. And when we're inside our window, we're able to consciously upgrade and downgrade our stress arousal and our emotions to keep our nervous system in a space of, you know, not being activated and when it doesn't need to be. And then when we're outside of our window, sometimes, you know, we're more likely to have our stress and our emotions driving our behavior and driving our decisions. And so the reason we call it a window of tolerance is because we can actually narrow it or widen it based on our experiences and choices that we're making each day.
That is absolutely fascinating. And thank you for that first oversight. So as a next point, could you please talk to us a bit about organizational trauma then? So what is it and how does that come about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I describe organizational trauma as the water that we're swimming in, right? So just like if you think about how as individuals we can get wounded, so too can our systems within our organizations. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because as human beings, we are the ones creating the system. So when we are wounded and carrying things like generational trauma and other forms of trauma into the workplace with us every day, that's the lens through which we are building our systems in our workplaces. So when we think about this idea of the water that we're swimming in, there's this anecdote about two fishes swimming. They're swimming along and another fish swims by and says, "Hey boys, how's the water today?" And the two fishes kind of swim along and then one looks at the other and says, "What the heck is water?" And so it's this idea that we are so collectively focused on addressing the overwhelming needs of the mission that we kind of stop noticing when things aren't right within the organization itself. And so over time, the cumulative impact of not addressing these issues as they come up becomes organizational trauma. And that gets woven into the fabric of organizational culture and then eventually becomes kind of the norm that we're swimming in. There are several factors that contribute to organizational trauma. So things like lack of transparency in organizational communications and decision-making, because this often leaves staff speculating and it leads to gossip about, you know, leadership motives and choices that are being made. And then top-down issues that don't consider workforce health and well-being, you know, they aren't considered as part of the policy making. Perceptions or actual racial, social, or other inequities or unfairness in the workplace, outdated policies, procedures, practices related to hiring, firing, promotions, and developmental opportunities, and then lack of acknowledgement of common, what I call occupational traumas that staff working in these particular fields often face that are a very real part of doing this work that often just goes unacknowledged.
I think in the environment that charities and humanitarian organizations are operating in at the moment, the risk of being subjected to trauma and traumatic situations must be particularly elevated because of the lack of resource that so many charities are feeling at the moment. And this sense of, you know, I'm trying to help people or causes that, you know, are in dire need at the moment and can see the resources are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, I mustn't be thinking about myself because their situation is so much worse. I think this is something that you touch upon in the book, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the kind of guilt that we carry as humanitarians or people working in service of others is so common. And there's a lot of comparison, right? So I remember being on assignment and feeling so bad about the fact that we were interviewing people who had lost everything. And yet, you know, we were staying in nicer places and things like that. So we will often do that to ourselves where we'll say, oh, you know, who am I to complain when this person, this group that I'm serving has it so much worse than I do? And so one of the things that I really try to work with leaders and others just working in the field is we can't compare our trauma. It is unfortunate, the traumas that others are experiencing, but it doesn't take away from the experiences that we've had. And we have to kind of keep that in mind because otherwise it's very easy to put ourselves and our needs at the very end. I mean, as it is, I think we do that anyway. We tend to deprioritize our own needs. But the reality is that we can't serve others effectively if we're not taking care of ourselves. And part of being able to take care of ourselves requires us to do things like set boundaries. And boundary setting is one of the most challenging things people can do. And oftentimes, again, it carries a lot of guilt and shame along with it. And so we want to start getting to this point where we recognize, hey, you know, I'm here to do something. I'm here to serve. I'm here to do a job that requires me to serve other people. And so that means we have to take care of ourselves, and our organizations need to be taking care of us as well so that we can continue to show up to do this work that's so important in the world.
Absolutely. And I think that's the really important point, which you've just touched on there, which is that if you are not able to look after your own well-being, then ultimately the quality of your work overall is going to suffer. And the knock-on impact of that is that the people that you are out there seeking to support, things will be materially worse as a result of that. We use the oxygen mask analogy quite a lot over here.
Exactly.
You cannot help others if your own oxygen mask is flapping somewhere around your head.
Exactly.
And so jumping off on that point, let's say you are a leader of a charity organization or a humanitarian organization, and you've recognized that you are within your organization grappling with organizational trauma, or you have maybe reached the end of your rope when it comes to managing the situations you're having to deal with at work. How do you then go about resolving that and kind of regaining that sort of necessary support for yourself?
For each person, it's going to be different, right? So again, it comes back to, first of all, what's my window of stress tolerance? And so in my book, I talk about five key things that we as individuals can be doing. And it's never going to be 100% the organization that is going to, well, the organizations are not going to save us. And it should not be 100% on us as individuals to fix what's happening. So it's a partnership that has to happen. So for individuals, there's kind of five key things that we can start working on. So number one is what I call taking radical responsibility. We have to think about taking responsibility and committing to ourselves and taking responsibility for our own health and well-being, the actions that we're taking. This does not let organizations off the hook, but it acknowledges that as individuals, we have to make changes for ourselves before we can make them as an organization. And then the next thing that's really important is embodying mindful awareness. And so a lot of times when I work with leaders and organizations, there's this feeling that, oh, you know, mindfulness isn't for me. But mindful awareness is an absolute foundational piece for any kind of healing, because, you know, we have to be able to recognize what's happening in terms of our thoughts, our emotions, our actions, our reactions in order to address them. And so being able to practice things like self-compassion, regulate our emotions, especially during times of stress and crisis, requires mindful awareness. When we talk about mindful awareness, we're not talking about, you know, mindfulness in terms of sitting on a cushion and meditating all day, though that's, you know, meditation is a fantastic resource that we have. But we're talking about this idea, the way that I often explain it is it's like going from watching a regular television to high definition, the program or whatever it is that you're experiencing or watching stays the same, but it's the quality and crispness that gets a little bit better. And that's what we're talking about, that with mindful awareness, we start to notice these things a little bit easier. And so when I work with groups, I often talk about this idea of notice, name, and navigate. So we start to notice, you know, our thoughts, our body responses, because those are very connected. We start to name the underlying emotions. And all of that helps us to navigate through kind of the stress and crisis and trauma. And then the third thing is redefining self-care. And so, you know, self-care has historically, unfortunately, been marketed as an indulgence. And so oftentimes when we think of self-care, we think of images of, you know, lounging in a tub filled with bubbles or sitting on a sofa, you know, reading a magazine with a cup of tea. And those are fine. You know, those are great ways to practice self-care. But really, I look at self-care as anything that helps us to calm our nervous system, because that's when we're in that place of smooth sailing in terms of our window of tolerance. So along with self-care goes, you know, the setting of clear boundaries. Again, because we'll never be able to prioritize self-care if we allow it to slide to the bottom of our list every time there's a more urgent matter that comes up at work or someone needs us to do something. And so boundary setting is, in theory, it's simple, but it is not easy. Anyone who's tried to set boundaries knows how challenging this can be. And part of this is that we weren't taught the benefits of boundary setting as children, most of us. And now in these kind of humanitarian or helping professions, honoring our own limits through boundary setting can feel rude or aggressive or selfish. But, you know, I like to try to think of boundary setting in a different way. I think of it as gifts of clarity that actually help us to create accountability over our time and energy.
All of those things that you've outlined, including self-care, setting boundaries, would be very difficult to do if you are working for an organization that doesn't promote, encourage, and support those practices. So particularly when you're working for a helping organization, as you put it, such as a charity, it's so important that you have staff well-being as a cornerstone of how you run your organization. And I know that this is something that you flag in your book. So I was wondering if you could give us some thoughts on how organizations can make well-being a fundamental part of their policies and processes.
As I said, I really believe that well-being can't be this add-on thing, right? It has to be woven into the fabric of our organizational culture. And so I talk about in the book about this idea of organizations committing to providing a holistic, human-centered duty of care. And that requires kind of four pillars that I talk about in the book. So number one, that requires normalizing and addressing occupational mental health challenges and traumas. And so this is about becoming trauma-informed organizations, designing cultures of empathy and compassion, and promoting trust and psychological safety across the organization. The second pillar is evolving from metrics-driven cultures into human-centered ones. And I always laugh here because I don't want people to think that I don't understand the value of metrics, because metrics are incredibly important. You know, they are what allow us to recognize if we are meeting our targets, if we are hitting, you know, the goals that we're setting as an organization. The problem becomes when metrics are the sole driving force behind our decision making. So, for example, in these kinds of humanitarian and helping fields, oftentimes we are looking at, you know, the number of cases that are completed or number of action steps taken without recognizing how this is impacting the well-being of the humans that are doing the work. And so that has to go hand in hand. And so evolving in this way requires prioritizing social connection in the workplace, healing root issues and organizational trauma, and creating opportunities to share stories, which often sounds a little strange to people. But again, that goes hand in hand with this idea of social connection as well. And then the third pillar is supporting rest and recovery. So this is creating conditions for work and recovery to coexist within the workplace, and also cultivating workplace cultures that value things like restorative care and promote rest rather than normalizing burnout. So we, you know, we operate in cultures, especially in these types of workplaces, where, again, our mission is focused on other human beings. And so there's this feeling of we have to keep giving, we have to keep giving. And we will often celebrate or wear, you know, our exhaustion as a badge of honor. And we need to stop doing that. We need to stop valuing that and instead encouraging people to rest, letting them know what happens, or, you know, like the good things that happen when we actually rest and how that then benefits the people that we're serving. And then the last pillar is fostering shared purpose and commitment. And so in this space, this is where we talk about things like offering developmental training and coaching and mentoring and providing ongoing meaningful feedback. And this is an important one because a lot of stress that's created in the workplace comes around feedback. And in my work with leaders, I've always talked about feedback is a conversation. And if we're doing it in a way that's meaningful, it's a two-way conversation. It's not one person at the end of the year or one time in the year giving all this information with no discussion, but rather it's an ongoing process where we have conversations along the way that not only look at the quality of the work being done, but they look at the person, right? The whole person that's sitting in front of you and asking, well, how's it going? What's happening with you? Has anything changed for you? So that we are getting to know each other on a more human to human level. And part of this, when we think about trust and psychological safety in the workplace, it doesn't happen as a result of a team building exercise or a single workshop. Trust and psychological safety are created over time. And the more that we have these conversations, the more that we create these spaces for people to connect, the more that we, you know, engage in this kind of storytelling in the workplace, the more we get to know each other, the more likely it is that when we encounter a challenging event like a pandemic or, you know, workplace violence, it's more likely that teams are going to come together rather than fall apart because they've already built that sense of trust amongst each other and that desire to want to step up and show up for each other.
Thank you so much. Absolutely fascinating points there. And so finally, I wonder, do you have, based on all of the different pillars that you've talked to us about there, any examples from the voluntary sector, from the helping sector, of organizations which, in your eyes, have really succeeded in that journey of trauma healing?
So I think it's very hard to say succeeded because this is an ongoing thing, right? So it's not a one and done. And I think that that's a really important thing for organizations to understand as well. A lot of times we see organizations, you know, wanting to, again, do a workshop or do a team building day, And often what I talk about is it's like putting a Band-Aid on a broken arm or checking off the box. It's not going to help in the long term. But I will say that there, you know, there's a handful of us that are doing this work. And so the good news is that we see organizations in these fields that are starting to create frameworks around which to start integrating some of these principles into their cultures. So one interesting example I can give you is this idea of storytelling as an intervention in organizations. For close to two decades, I worked for a government agency here in the United States, focusing on asylum and refugee adjudications. And so occupational mental health challenges like vicarious trauma, secondary traumatic stress, critical incident stress, compassion fatigue, moral injury, these were all very common experiences for our staff. But again, there was such a stigma associated with mental health that many of us kind of suffered in silence for decades. And so the culture that we were in, you know, the mission itself was very meaningful, but it was also very fast paced, very high stakes, very stressful. And so the stress combined with, especially here in the States, the politicization of, you know, asylum and refugee work by different administrations, it was perpetuating this idea that who we were as individuals and the work we were doing didn't matter as much as the people that we were trying to serve. And so this was the culture within which we were operating in March 2020 when COVID hit. It was really interesting because very quickly organizational leaders decided to pivot to 100% telework, but their expectations of staff productivity remained the same, with no consideration for how uncertainty and grief and social isolation were impacting people. And so this just kind of further exacerbated staff feeling unseen and unvalued, and it just further traumatized organizational culture. And so I had a very small staff, and we were focused on workforce well-being. And so what we did was we created something called coffee chats. And it was this idea, these kind of 45-minute facilitated sessions with no more than 10 to 12 people. And we focused on the topics that we were hearing were impacting people. So things like fear of, like the uncertainty and fear, anxiety, grief, social isolation, or, you know, things, other things that colleagues were trying to navigate. We wanted to create what we call brave spaces for people to come together and openly share their experiences. And we call them brave spaces because, especially for people of color or other kind of underserved populations, there isn't such a thing as a safe space. And brave spaces recognizes our humanity, that we all carry scars, we've all created wounds for other people. And it recognizes our imperfections, that when we gather in these spaces, we may say something wrong. We may say, you know, say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. And so it's our willingness to take accountability and ownership over that, though. Again, there's so much power in having your story witnessed by other people. So it allowed people to be seen and heard in that space, but it also created this sense of common humanity because people realized, oh, I'm not the only one going through this. And a lot of times when we're in that mental health space of feeling anxious, of feeling depressed, or whatever it is that we're feeling, it can feel very isolating. And we will often think, oh, I'm the only one experiencing this. And then that's what creates the shame, right? And so this helped to take some of that away.
It's great. And such a simple idea, really, when you think about it, but just demonstrating that changing things a little bit and bringing in something like that can have such a positive effect on an organization. Dimple Dabalia, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting to hear from you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be talking once again about technological innovations in the charity space. And if you enjoy the Third Sector podcast, I'd like to take this opportunity to encourage you to please leave us a positive rating on your podcast platform, even a review if you feel like it, and also to subscribe to or follow the show. Both of these simple actions would really help us. So for now, thank you to our guest, Dimple Dabalia, and our producer, Nav Powell.